Accountability after Parkland, closing a homeless camp, and dirty money from Venezuela. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Four school employees at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Parkland were reassigned this week, months after the tragedy. It led to teacher and student protests on campus. Meantime, the FBI will beef up its tip line, the same line that missed tips before the shooting. Fort Lauderdale this week cleared out a downtown homeless encampment. This time is different, the city says. The effort comes with shelter and job assistance and addiction treatment. Also, a former treasurer in Hugo Chavez's government in Venezuela is sentenced in South Florida for his role in a massive money laundering scheme that included condominiums here. Your phone calls and tweets coming up on the South Florida Roundup next on WLRN. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. It has been almost 10 months now since the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. In addition to the wave of student activism since then, there's been an effort to understand the events that led to February 14th and look for accountability. According to the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, with the published report today, the Broward County School District knew more than it let on. It found the district hired lawyers and public relations consultants to keep information from the public. A statement to WLRN from the Broward County Public Schools this afternoon read, "We respect our obligation to keep the community informed." The Broward School statement continued, saying that it has a responsibility to adhere to what, quote, "we are legally permitted to release and acknowledge that we may not have done it perfectly every time. When it comes to navigating in an environment that is so highly sensitive and one in which we are trying to be thoughtful while being thorough in our responses, if there have been shortcomings, it has never been our intention to mislead," end quote. A state commission began its own separate investigation back in April. This week, the FBI said it is planning to upgrade its public tip line. That's after it was found that the FBI mishandled warnings about the confessed shooter before the shooting at Stoneman Douglas in February. Also this week, Broward Schools announced four Stoneman Douglas staffers were reassigned. Parents of the shooting victims see the reassignments as a step toward holding school district employees accountable for mistakes made before, during, and after the shooting, such as leaving a school gate open or failing to call a code red when the shooting began. Andrew Pollack lost his daughter Meadow in the shooting.
"You know, I'm never going to see my kid again. And people need to be held accountable for their failures. And for these teachers to be out there protesting for these administrators that failed me and the other families miserably, leading up to the 14th and the 14th, it's a disgrace."
14th, a reference to February 14th, the date of the school shooting. We did see that Marjorie Stoneman Douglas teachers protesting the reassignment of some of their colleagues this week. The state passed a law after the Parkland shooting requiring an armed guard on every school campus and allowing school employees to be armed if approved. There's also money set aside for mental health services. So what changes have been made to your school in the aftermath of Parkland? Liam is in 12th grade in Fort Lauderdale. Liam wrote us, "Since the Parkland shooting, my school has added a fence perimeter around the entrance past the parking lots. They force all students to wear IDs at all times or risk getting detentions or referrals." Willie in Oakland Park wrote us, "We have brought in an outside security company 24/7. Our campus gates are closed during certain hours. Students and staff have color-coded lanyards that must be worn. We have also implemented new lockdown emergency plans and protocols this year. We have school-wide drills regularly." What's the experience in your neighborhood? Maybe you're a parent, a grandparent, aunt or uncle, an employee, a spouse of an employee. Maybe you do some work at the school. Maybe you're a former student or for that matter, a current student. Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. 800-743-9576. You can also tweet the program at WLRN. Joining us now, WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman, our Broward County reporter, WLRN's Katie Swatowski, with us in studio here in Miami. To you two ladies, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
We also have via FaceTime the Sun Sentinel's Brittany Wallman. Brittany, welcome back to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank
as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your report that your media organization published today on this Friday. Walk through the information, the new information that the Sun Sentinel has that you claim that the district has not disclosed, the school district has not disclosed to the community.
Well, from the beginning, the superintendent Runcy said that, you know, the district would engage this independent outside review of what happened. And then it turned out we found that it was not an independent review or really an outside review, that the school district's law firm hired a consultant that in the contract, it clearly says that their purpose was not to find out what went wrong and answer the community's questions, but it was to defend the district against all of these lawsuits. We also were able to obtain Nicholas Cruz's school file through leaks. And I have to say that most people probably don't realize it, but yes, we know a lot about what happened. It's not because the school district told us, it's because information has been leaked.
District will say and has said, not only to you and the Sun Sentinel, I'm guessing, but certainly to us here at the WLRN, that these educational records are private. They're protected by certain privacy laws.
That's right. And I totally respect the laws that they're trying to navigate here. What we haven't seen is, any bending over backwards to try to release what can be released. DCF went to court and said
the Department of Children and Families.
Yes, sorry. I hate acronyms. So they said, court, we recognize that there are federal privacy laws in play here, but the public's right to know and the desire to prevent something like this from happening again should trump those. We have a confessed killer here. And the judge said, yes, go ahead and release. And the school district hasn't taken that position. And we also know, like I said, they're defending against litigation. And so they've also, you haven't seen a lot of public speaking from even the elected officials who should be more free to, communicate with families and with the public on this because they're afraid of the lawsuits.
Now, while the school records have certainly been in focus and how the confessed shooter of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas behaved in the years and months and weeks leading up to the shooting, your organization, the Sun Sentinel, reporting certain assessments that have been included in the record that has been leaked to you in October of 2013, many years before the shooting. Confessed shooter had said, quote, "I would rather be on the street killing animals and setting fires." That same year, according to another report, asking what did it sound like when Abraham Lincoln was shot. His eighth grade teacher that year reporting, quote, "I strongly feel that the confessed shooter is a danger to the students and faculty at this school." Were those statements included in official education records that you saw?
All of that and a whole lot more along those lines is in Nicholas's school file. But the consultant's report that the district released did not contain those. It did not really get into the fact that, they had him in the system from age three because he had been kicked out of both daycares. He was a problem from the very beginning, attacking other children. And so there was no really assessment of how do you treat somebody that has shown violent tendencies from pre-K, and why would you place him in Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School when he never thrived in any school other than a school that was for profoundly troubled children?
We're speaking with Brittany Wallman, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Jessica Bakeman, our education reporter, Katie Swatowski, our Broward County reporter here at WLR, and also with us. There are multiple investigations that are going on. There's certainly the criminal investigation related to the prosecution of the confessed shooter in the case. There is the review that the school district itself has undertaken in this regard. And then there's the state commission that has gotten a lot of attention here because it has been deemed with certain powers that these other types of investigations may or may not have. But Katie Swatowski, as this state commission has worked, give us kind of what the environment has been like just in the past week as it held some hearings.
So it was, I believe, 2 weeks ago now that the commission met in November. And it's really, you notice more tension, absolutely, between commission members. I think that's something Jessica and I have talked a lot about, is the environment there has gone from tense and sad to tense and angry, I think is a good way to describe it, because now is the time that they're trying to put together these reports. High profile people, including the FBI, are not showing up for testimonies. And now is the time where they've got to say, okay, here's everything that we've seen. And by January 1, release a report that says, we recommend every school in the state of Florida do X, Y, and Z.
And so the commission has been meeting since April. Obviously, it was created by the legislature. But I think that the November meeting was really kind of the biggest fireworks that we've seen. And we've seen more kind of fallout from that. Yeah. So in the November meeting, they went through this really lengthy, detailed presentation that showed the individual response of certain law enforcement officers, of certain people who worked the school, literally every second after the first shots were fired on February 14th. And since then, you know, the captain with Broward Sheriff's Office who was in charge that day has resigned. She was described during the investigation as being ineffective, as being in over her head.
And in so a trance.
In a trance-like situation, yes. So she resigned, and then obviously this week we saw the school district take action against four staff members at the school. Both of those things came as a direct result of what was learned during the investigation.
Katie, is this the accountability that those have been directly involved with the shooting, the parents especially, have been asking for, have been demanding?
Partially. To an extent, I think parents are happy to see anything done at this point and anyone held accountable for a mistake that day. And there were many to hold people accountable for. But what's really interesting is now you have three groups. You have the parents that are happy to see this action. You have the teachers that are devastated by being shifted and broken up. And then you have students in the middle who are just trying to go to history class. Yeah. And they don't know. I mean, they're students on both sides. But talking about, you know, the law enforcement response and the school response and the family reaction to both has been so sad to see that families are not on the same page. You have families on both sides, you know, supporting law enforcement or supporting, you know, more approaches that they can do. So
there have been a lot of tough weeks, but I think this was a tough week
for the people
that are involved with this and still dealing with it. You know, I talked to a couple of teachers that I've been in touch with since the shooting, and they're really devastated. They feel like their family has been ripped apart. They, you know, we don't know too much about what, you know, these individuals are accused of doing wrong. The school district reassigned them to other administrative positions outside the school and didn't specifically say, you know, this person did this. We have some details about that from the investigation, but basically the teachers are saying, well, these administrators have been there for us. They've helped us get through this. You're not even telling us why you're moving them. And we had one teacher who spoke at this school safety forum on, I believe it was Tuesday night. And I guess we have a clip so you can hear what she said to Superintendent Robert Runcie.
Yeah, this is Penny Pagano, facilitator for students with special needs at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. It was at this forum that she was speaking with. School safety forum on Tuesday night, talking with the superintendent at Broward County Public Schools, Robert Runcie, that about the reaction that she saw with her students when they learned about the reassignment of some of these school administrators.
Do you know what our kids are feeling? Do you know how many teachers cried today and did not want to go into their classrooms? They didn't want to face the kids. The kids are distraught. You again helped rip our school apart. We are back to the week after February 14th.
Really difficult to listen to today, being so separated from it, but just raw emotion still here. And understandably so, Jessica. What was the justification for the school district reassigning these four school personnel. Employees, three of them, right. I think, were administrators.
Three were assistant principals, and the other one is a security specialist. The people I talked to at the school said he was basically in charge of security. And again, the school district hasn't given a specific reasons. Some of the details that are included in the state investigation, for one of the assistant principals, Jeff Morford, it was found in the investigation that someone had overheard him having a conversation with other staff members last year saying the confessed shooter, predicting that he would likely become a school shooter, mm-hmm. and saying that maybe this assistant principal would be his first target because they apparently had had some conflicts. And that was like, they were joking about that. Mm-hmm. So that came out. And I think the key there, obviously it's uncomfortable and difficult to hear anybody making jokes about this, but obviously it was before anything happened. But I think the point being that, you know, people knew that this individual was dangerous, and maybe they didn't do enough to, you know, try to get him in a situation where he wouldn't be able to do what he did. Another one of the assistant principals, there were just a lot of communication issues. I mean, we've heard about this. Yeah. There was like the radios weren't working. And so at one point, this other assistant principal, Winfred Porter, was talking with police, and the police said, this surveillance footage that we're watching, is it live? And he said, yeah, it is live. But it wasn't live. It was delayed by 26 minutes. And because of that delayed footage, police and medics hesitated before they moved up to the third floor of the building where the shooting had taken place, which left 10 people who had been shot, you know, waiting there for help. He later said it wasn't live, but, you know, that was just one of the ways that he sort of contributed toward that.
Brittany Wallman, one of the criticisms, of course, 10 months after, is accountability within the systems here, the systems of law enforcement, the systems of the school district, and the systems of the response even after, days and weeks after, and the support for the Parkland community and others dealing with this tragedy. Is that accountability changing with the actions that the school district has taken in the last week with these four individuals?
I think it will help, but, you know, I mean, the whole community is hurting, and what they don't want to see is that the agencies that are in charge and that screwed up circle the wagons and try to protect any of their employees. They want every rock unturned, and that, you know, the school district and law enforcement and everyone else would be all part of the team trying to make sure that every mistake is uncovered and everyone admits to everything. So I think that, you know, it helps, but people are still, you know, they're, you know, they want heads to roll, I have to say.
I think there's, if I can just jump in, I think there's a lot of skepticism too, because of some of the problems pointed out in the Sun Sentinel's report today with how the school district hasn't always been super transparent about everything, and similar problems with the Broward Sheriff's Office. There's a lot of skepticism, like, are these leaders really going to hold people accountable? Are they just, like, when I covered the walkout, the students walked out of class to protest the reassignment of those individuals. And one of the students I talked to said, you know, these people are just being scapegoated. Really, shouldn't it be the principal who's held responsible? Shouldn't it be the superintendent who's held responsible? Those two are in ultimately those larger positions of power.
Sure.
And, you know, also there was it came out during the investigation that there was a member of BSO who had got into the school in time to hear the shots. So the shooting was still going on, and he got out of his car and he took like a minute and a half to put on his bulletproof vest. Mm-hmm. And
that's a huge problem.
And a couple of people on the commission were saying, you know, listen, if you choose to not wear your vest all the time, you don't get to take a minute and a half to put it on. You have to go in. And Andrew Pollock, who I spoke with, who you mentioned, you know, his daughter Meadow died. He's been tweeting a lot about that and talking about that because he wants to get that person fired, you know? So it's like there's a lot of like institutional and individual accountability that still is to come.
This is the first step, but I think that people still want to see a lot more.
And the accountability, the results of whatever that accountability certainly are going to be felt locally in the Parkland community, in the Broward County Public School District community, but even more widely throughout Florida. We've seen this already with the legislation passed in the wake of Parkland. This report from the state commission to go to the legislature for the 2019 session is going to make some recommendations. Some of those recommendations may lead to new legislation regarding school safety, regarding school security, regarding law enforcement. enforcement responses or whatnot. And we asked this week the South Florida community about what changes that you have seen in your community schools as a result of the Parkland tragedy and the legislation passed immediately afterward. Boca Raton, Jenny on line one, you've been very patient. Go ahead, Jenny. What's your experience after Parkland?
My experience is that I noticed definitely heightened security. My children are both in elementary school in Boca Raton. They do wear security badges, all the children, different colors for different classes. But the change that we felt the most is the changes they've made to letting parents on campus. They've no longer held campus-wide events for holidays, and when they do, they're closed off to maybe one or two parents who have to pre-register. But they've really shut down on opening the school to the parents and the community to come in and be a part of that school culture. And that's the biggest change that I've personally felt.
We've talked a lot about the specific changes that have happened, but I think it's important for us to think about the kind of big picture changes of like how life is changing in public schools for students, for teachers, for parents, what the experience of going to school is like now. And obviously the caller mentioned the feeling that parents are not as welcome or able to participate. And there's also, you know, this push to, I believe probably the legislature will pass a law based on the recommendations mandating that teachers learn how to do this stop the bleed, the bleeding control. Mm. And they're also putting bleeding.
Is that like a first aid kind of?
It's a paramedic training essentially.
I see, okay.
Yeah, and they're putting stop the bleed kits that have gauze and tourniquets in every public school in Broward. They already have one in every classroom at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Mm. And, you know, every teacher in Florida may have to learn how to stop the bleeding of a gunshot wound if someone is shot in their classroom. And these are the sort of realities that are now becoming a part of, like, what it means to go to school.
Yeah, Jenny, let me ask you, as a parent, you mentioned elementary school kids. From a couple of years ago to this year, what's been your experience in the change of the classroom experience for your children?
I think some of the changes have been very positive, and I have no disrespect for the changes that they're making. In all honesty, there isn't a day that goes by that my children don't walk out the door, and I pray that they're brought back to me safely. But we have to move on with our lives, and I still strongly support our public school system. I'm happy with the children wearing their badges. I'm fine with the drills that they do. I think that they're handled very appropriately, and they're teaching our children to see something, to say something. I love the relationships that they've made with the policemen on their campus. I think that that's building a really strong community. I know our school has gotten walkie-talkies for most of the teachers. They also carry a red backpack every time they leave a classroom. The school that my children go to, every classroom is open to the outside. It's always remained locked, and I'm fine with that. So I don't feel that the school's become too locked down. I'm absolutely fine with the kind of security that they have. I just do feel the loss in the sense of community with having Halloween events and Thanksgiving mm-hmm. events mm-hmm. and school events. That's the loss that I feel a little bit is that I respect that, but it does feel like a sense of loss for building a community.
And Jenny, you bring up a really good point that I just want to make sure all of our listeners know, at least in Broward County, these types of measures are implemented really not uniformly per school. It is very much school by school basis.
Right.
So it really depends on where your kids are going to school and how comfortable individual families are with that, because if you're looking at a school in a different neighborhood, they could have completely different
Absolutely.
Procedures.
Yeah. I noticed it with my friends in the same area whose children go to different schools. I would say that a lot of these changes were developed. There was a parent safety coalition that was created after the Stoneman Douglas shooting. And so a lot of these changes were developed by the parents at the school. And every parent has been open to join this coalition and speak their voice as to whether they agree or disagree. And the staff has done a wonderful job of including the parents in these decisions. So I respect why they're doing it, and we just kind of work extra harder to find that community outside of school, and when there is an opportunity to be at the school, you do see a huge involvement. People still really do believe in their public schools and really want to make them a safe and happy place for our children.
And I think we can look no further than the two recent elections where voters in Broward County approved higher taxes to pay teachers more, and voters in Palm Beach County and Miami-Dade County did the same, and voters in Monroe County okayed higher taxes to pay for security measures as well. Jenny, a parent in Boca Raton. Jenny, take the afternoon off. No homework. All right, Jenny?
thanks so much.
All right.
Happy Friday.
Thank you for sharing your experiences. Very important to hear from parents there. Brittany Wallman, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel via FaceTime. Brittany, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Roundup. Jessica Bakeman, Katie Swietlowski covering education in Broward County, respectively. Jessica, thank you for your reporting here. Katie, you stick around. We got a lot to talk about, including this homeless encampment in downtown Fort Lauderdale.
We do.
Clearing it out again, but the city and county say this time it's different. That's coming up next as the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening. This week, Broward County officials cleared out a homeless camp in downtown Fort Lauderdale. About 80 people were living in tents in front of the county's main library. It's not the first time officials have tried to remove the camp, but this time is different, they say. Here's Rebecca McGuire with the county's Homeless Initiative Partnership.
And people will ask, well, why now? Well, why now is when we got the business community involved in April, the resources came to light. I mean, for us to be able to house people, we needed resources. We needed money to do it. And so we have that now.
The county partnered with the City of Fort Lauderdale, United Way, and other business and nonprofit groups. More than 40 partners in all were included. Now, they want people living in this camp to transition to more permanent housing. James Donnelly is the CEO of property management company, The Castle Group. He's one of the co-chairs of the Broward Business Council on Homelessness.
It was literally a different solution for every person in the encampment. It took 6 months of prep, and it's going to take another 6 months to get them where they need to be.
Joining us again, talking about this plan, Sun Sentinel reporter Brittany Wallman and WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Swietlowski. 800-743-WLRN, do you live and work near where this homeless camp was in Fort Lauderdale? Had you seen it? Perhaps you went to dinner, the theater? You exercise around that area. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. Katie, describe what this camp looked like and was when it was filled with people.
Well, this time last week, there was about 80 tents and 80 people permanently living full-time on this plaza in front of the county's main library, to varying degrees of need, right? So some people are working two and three jobs. A lot of people on that plaza were working and just can't make it to first, last security. But then you have people with some severe mental health issues that need to be addressed. So it's a wide range of people, and the plaza was full at all times. I mean, it really was. Police officers are always stationed across the street. It's its own neighborhood,
yeah.
Per se.
It was both, Brittany, easy to miss and hard to miss at the same time, because it had been there so long for folks that live and work in that area. Perhaps
you get used to it.
But for new visitors, you couldn't help but look at this and say it looks like a protest or some kind of camp, which is what it was, a camp.
I work out of that library a lot some afternoons, and you find the regular people you say hi to and on your way in and out. And it's this its own network of people
coming and going. Its own
community,
its own neighborhood.
It was really interesting. If you parked and just watched, you would see Good Samaritans pull up with a stack full of pizza boxes. And a lot of people knew that that's where, if you wanted to help the homeless, you could bring them food or, little supplies.
So we heard from some of the folks involved that this time will be different. And the involvement of the business community since April in Broward County helped marshal the resources here. But what is different about this time around? And Katie, specifically about how the county and the city went about clearing the encampment. Start there before we talk about the services.
Yeah, so a year and a half ago, overnight, the city of Fort Lauderdale came in with bulldozers, and it was a very jarring experience. They tried to clear the camp in a day, basically, and that did not bode well for anyone because the community came back. So this time when they were looking at it, what they needed was this push from the private enterprise community. And once that started in April, they have been putting together money for two different types of housing transitions. And they were calling it a home for the holidays. So for anybody that lives in the area, they're like, okay, is this really going to happen, a home for the holidays? But right now, the camp was cleared out fully yet by yesterday afternoon?
Yeah,
and they started on Monday.
4 days, five days.
So if you didn't know what was going on behind the scenes, this looked like it happened very quickly. And I think the difference is they are assigning case managers, one case manager to every 12 to 15 people that will visit them several times a week and follow up on two different housing models. One is called rapid rehousing, which is for the people that just need a real quick, help getting first, last security mm-hmm. or a little bit of rent assistance. And they'll be short term. But the other type of permanent solutions housing is to help people in the long run.
Brittany, where is this housing coming from in notoriously affordable housing short Broward County in South Florida?
Right.
Where are these units all of a sudden appearing from? Or my perception probably is wrong, not all of a sudden appearing, but where are they coming from?
Well, these are market rate, and we know how expensive that is, apartments. And I mean, a lot of the people are first being put in motels. The United Way is still pleading for landlords out there who will want that steady check from, government mm-hmm. for the, and some of these homeless people, I think they said out of the 80 individuals, that 26 of the households will have permanent housing. So they're recognizing that that's the fraction that is never going to be capable of being self-sustaining. And so that's one of the big differences here, is that if you've been around in Broward for a long time, you know they've tried so many different things. Like one year they bought bus passes and tried to send everybody back up north to their families. And the thing is, they keep coming back to downtown because that's where the hospital is, that's where the jail is. The main library has bathrooms, it has
Wi-Fi.
Computers. I mean, it's right. ideal. I work there too.
Yeah. So where is the funding coming from for this though, Katie?
It's business. It's, they've got some very frustrated business members who were very tired of looking down from their offices and seeing that camp.
Several
they
companies
really,
thought about leaving, and that was really what kind of spurred,
right.
I think, city and county government, hey, we've got to do something about this now because we have large corporations that are not happy with their employees' quality of life, and they are angry.
The economic threat of employment. Rose is on line one in Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
Thanks for listening, Rose. Go ahead with your question.
Hi there. Yes, I am one of those bleeding heart person who go there once a month to bring food and clothes for these people. But I would like to know, where have they placed them?
So, Rose, I'll answer that for you because two things I want to mention. One, the county is really discouraging anybody from doing this feeding at this plaza because they want to retrain community behavior. So instead of bringing food yourself, they are suggesting you bring food to some of their centers, and like the Broward Partnership. Mm. They have a huge cafeteria that they need help with. And where they're going right now, most of them are in motels. They're being put up by the Broward Business Council, county money, and Fort Lauderdale in motels. And most of them, the goal is to transition them into apartments.
But how long can they sustain housing?
I'm glad you asked.
In motels?
Yeah. So right now their bucket is almost $4 million. Mm. They have the money right now to anyone that they place in an apartment can be there for up to a year if they are fully assisting them. A lot of these people, like I was saying earlier, they're thinking they're only going to have to help for 3 to 6 months with some assistance here and there.
What about the mental health component of this?
That's where the caseworkers come in.
Right. And the addiction treatment. As we know, there's a component of homelessness that is associated with that. It's in the general population. It's in any population. But certainly with the homeless, what kind of availability to treatment is the population that once called this camp home are having access to as the tents have been taken down?
And Brittany can speak to this too, but I know right now that these caseworkers, the goal is to visit at least twice a week with each individual and connect them to Broward's sort of extensive core of services mm-hmm. and make sure that they get on, see a psychologist, see a psychiatrist. The idea is to get these people on a medication management program that they can stick to.
And also, you know, just to hop in there, one of the reasons why a lot of these people were living there is they lacked the ID to get an apartment. And, you know, it sounds like a minor thing to those of us that have a driver's license, but a lot of these people don't have their birth certificate. Maybe it was thrown away by the city last year.
When they cleared out the camps with the bulldozer, yeah.
Yeah.
That happened
and
for many people.
So this effort is also going to help people get the ID they need, pay that deposit to get into the apartment, and just get them on their feet. But it also acknowledges, and this is a national sort of new trend, this to actually house the homeless. You know, it's acknowledging that some people are going to need help forever, or they'll be back there.
And I want to ask about that, Brittany and Katie, in terms of plans for this space. Previous efforts to clear out the camp, while disruptive, as you described, Katie, a year ago, the camp came back. This time, perhaps, there's more financial resources behind providing the kinds of services that this population needs. But what are the plans for this
plaza,
for this space?
So there's been a huge renovation project planned by the county for years now, and they just have not been able to come in and do it. And I was at the camp this morning, and right now it's a fence and a series of barricades. So every time they took a tent down, they put an orange barricade so that someone couldn't come in and put another tent up. And that's all fenced off as of this morning. And the idea is now the county can come in and not only renovate the pool in the middle of the plaza, but they have a couple of construction projects they want to do. One of them on the side of the library are these terraces that are on the side of the library that have, you know, the county says are crumbling. They consider it a safety hazard.
Will this construction kind of take place in a way that will prevent any future encampment from returning?
That's the goal.
Katie Swotowski covering Broward County for us here at WLRN. Brittany Wallman with us via FaceTime from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Brittany, thanks so much for your time. Katie, thanks as always for sharing your reporting with us here at WLRN. We got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. A former money man for Hugo Chavez in Venezuela goes to jail here in Florida for helping funnel dirty money into local real estate. That's all ahead as the Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Venezuela dirty money crept up again this week here in South Florida. An ex-treasurer for former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez faces prison time. 54-year-old Alejandro Andrada was sentenced in West Palm Beach Federal Court to 10 years for his role in a $1 billion bribery and money laundering scheme. He used the money to buy several luxury properties, including some in Wellington in Palm Beach County. That included an equestrian farm housing prized show horses. Also helped create a circle of officials and high-profile businessmen to get richer. So let's talk about this case and the larger practice in Venezuela and the economic crisis there and how it continues to impact South Florida. Antonio Delgado is back with us from El Nuevo Herald from our studios in Doral. Antonio, welcome back to the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Jay Weaver with our partner, the Miami Herald, is with us here in our downtown studios. Jay, always great to have you on. Thanks for taking time out from your court duties.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure thing. And WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure and honor to have you on here.
As it is for me.
Antonio, let's start here. Describe this character, this Alejandro Andrada, the former treasurer for Chavez.
Yes, he's a military officer, very close to Hugo Chavez. He was the head of the National Treasury from between 2007 to 2010. He was somebody who benefited from being in Chavez's shadow to the point where he was approached by businessmen friendly to the regime and were proposed to participate in a series of corruption schemes to a point where he admitted to officials here of taking the equivalent of $1 billion worth of bribes to be able to allow some of these businessmen to have access to a favorable foreign exchange rate, which became one of the main mechanisms in Venezuela to become rich real quickly.
So describe as best you can how the scheme worked, how this exchange rate scheme worked for him to exponentially increase the riches of these folks that he was working with.
One of the things the government did was take basically control of all foreign exchange, of the dollars coming into the country before were available for private sector businesses, companies, and anybody could buy dollars at some point. They took a hold of that and basically set up a very strict control system with different levels of foreign exchange. In the end, there was an official exchange rate that it was very low in comparison to what's available to most of the people, which became the black market rate, which was legal to deal with, but which was what most people had access to. So in the end, if you had you were friendly to the regime, or if you had you were friends with Andrade, you were able to have access to this low exchange rate. And if not, you had to go to the black market.
So, Jay Weaver, this was the scheme in Venezuela. What was the crime in the United States?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, this is sort of a novel approach to foreign corruption, because what they've done here is essentially charge not only Venezuelan nationals, very politically connected Venezuelan nationals, but also they have charged a few others outside that circle and one or two here. There are two separate cases, and essentially they're charging them with a conspiracy to commit money laundering. And so the crime in Venezuela is corruption, paying bribes to officials like Alejandro Andrade, the former national treasurer. And then what happens is all their ill-gotten gains of the embezzled or stolen money from the Venezuelan National Treasury or from the National Oil Company is then transferred to Europe. And then it's transferred to the Dominican Republic. And then it's transferred to New York. And then it's transferred to the United States. There's various ways the money was moved here. Ultimately, the idea is to move it to South Florida to invest in reliable, ever-growing real estate. Mm-hmm. And that's the scheme. And as soon as the money hits the wires and goes through the banks and comes into the United States, it's considered tainted. And the underlying crime, of course, is the bribery that occurred and the corruption that occurred in Venezuela. But again, they're strictly charging them with money laundering.
Right, right. The United States, that's what the crime was. That's what the sentence was related for.
Correct. Yeah. And you know, and just to point out really quickly, and I don't want to overcomplicate this, but Alejandro Andrade was sort of in the center of one big scheme involving, you know, that was masterminded by a man that, you know, you all know as Raul Gorin. He is wanted. He's a fugitive. He's in Venezuela. And then there was a separate scheme that was charged that was equally big, another billion-dollar scheme, which we may want to get into also.
So, Antonio, describe Gorin for us, and who is he, what do American prosecutors want him for?
Well, he's the current owner of Global Vision. He's a lawyer with very humble beginnings. And somehow, early in the Chavez government, he was able to get in touch with key people. And it was through this foreign exchange corruption schemes that he amassed a huge fortune. And all of a sudden, he's able to purchase a large insurance company that also benefited from state contracts and made the controversial purchase of TV network GlobalVision, which was very... he got into a lot of political trouble because of that, because at that point he was the only independent news service in Venezuela. And once he purchased that, they adopted a new pro-government editorial line, which a lot of people complained about.
An indictment against Gorin was unsealed, Jay, right before or right essentially during this announcement of the sentence of Andrade, correct?
Right. And in fact, it was kind of confusing because these cases had been under seal for months, meaning that they were not open to the public. And then what happened was a week ago Monday, Gorin was charged by indictment in the one case that implicated Andrade. And then Andrade's case was unsealed the next day. He was charged separately because he had been cooperating secretly with the government for the last year, the government meaning the U.S. government. And he was the key witness. I mean, without Andrade, they would not have been able to make the case against Gorin and others. And of course, this is independent of the other money laundering case they brought against 9 Venezuelan nationals and a Miami money broker last summer or this summer.
Right, and that was a case that saw a lot of money funneled into South Florida real estate.
Correct. And in fact, both cases have seen a lot of money. When I say a lot of money, I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Flowing into high-rise condos, not only in the Brickell area, but in the Sunny Isles
and horse estates in Palm Beach County.
That's correct. Yeah. And so, you know, and you see, you know, money being spent on jets, fleets of luxury cars, all kinds of things. The typical kind of money laundering pursuits of these types of businessmen. So, yes, the second case involved a different era. While the Andrade case was sort of centered around the Chavez era, the second case involving these 9 defendants, it's the same scheme, exploiting the same currency exchanges for magnifying ill-gotten gains, but they were tapping into the oil income of the national oil company PDVSA, and they were moving the monies again through through Europe and then into the United States into real estate. It was separate schemes, but they represent multiple billions of dollars.
Yeah, Tim Padgett, the precedent here, not unique in any one of the cases that Jay and Antonio described.
No, this is a long-standing corruption scheme in Venezuela that predates Hugo Chavez coming to power back in 1999. As you can see, I'm holding in my hand here, this is just the third volume of a book called El Diccionario de la Corrupción in Venezuela, the Dictionary of Venezuelan Corruption.
The third volume, and what are the dates on that one?
This is goes up to 1992.
That's when it stops.
And that's when it stops. Yeah. And not coincidentally, that was the same year Hugo Chavez attempted a coup in Venezuela, which was cheered by the people, largely because of the corruption that was going on. And one of the biggest scandals was a scandal just like this one Jay and Antonio and we have been talking about, which was manipulating these foreign currency controls to make massive profits. There is a scandal in here called the Riccati scandal from the late 1980s, 1990s, which yielded $11 billion in ill-gotten gains. And this book describes it as the culmination of the process of moral degradation in Venezuela. So the Chavistas, the socialists in Venezuela, really what they've done is just taken an old Venezuelan scheme and updated it and refined it and made even more billions off it.
You got to remind me not to join the Padgett Book Club with that in the library, Jay and Antonio. I'm not sure quite up for that. But of course, the historic corruption, Tim, that is in your library, and you just quoted there from the 80s, and Jay, that you and Antonio have documented with these cases here, it comes to roost in South Florida in a way that is very real in the economy, in not only consumer spending, extravagant consumer spending, but also in terms of real estate. And so, Antonio, just describe, if you could, give us an example of kind of how this has manifested itself, these two schemes, or maybe just the one where we had the sentencing this week with Andrade, the former treasurer in the Chavez administration, about how this wound up in the South Florida economy, how this dirty money wound up circulating in the financial system and the economy here.
Yeah, well, in these two cases, there was a lot of money that went to real estate, actually, you know, very rich, very expensive properties. But Venezuelan money have been coming into the real estate market for years. And with it has been a lot of legitimate money, people who were able to invest through the years. And actually, part of Doral, where the Miami Herald, the Annual Herald, have its headquarters, a lot of the development here was actually built from people buying apartments from Venezuela into this area. So that's been taking place for a long time. What looks kind of funny to most Venezuelans is the fact that the Chavista regime for years have had this anti-American rhetoric, and then a great number of officials there made their money through corruption and end up buying property here. So there's a contradiction there that most Venezuelans are aware of.
Yeah, Jay. The rhetoric coming out of Caracas for years and years and years, but the actual actions being taken by these corrupt officials in not only creating the corruption, but then quickly getting out their ill-gotten gains into what they deemed as a safer environment, safer financial environment.
Right. I mean, as Tony pointed out, the hypocrisy here is grotesque. And you can only imagine.
Only rivaled by the corruption.
Right. But, I mean, to really bring it home, on the one hand, it has fueled the high-end luxury market of condominiums. But from a, you know, ground-up perspective, the average Miamian can no longer afford to buy a home, a modest home, a condominium, a modest condominium, because it is no small amount of influence. This money pouring into the real estate market here by foreigners, some of it clean, some of it dirty, has really pushed up the prices of all real estate. And the incomes here of average Miamians do not keep pace. And you, Tom, being an economic expert, know this all too well.
Yeah, very true. We got to leave it there, gentlemen, but appreciate the conversation. Jay Weaver right there from our partner, the Miami Herald. Antonio Delgado with us from El Nuevo Herald in Doral. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Gentlemen, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the roundup. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado, our digital director. Terrence Shepard, our news director. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Our director of radio operations here at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Director of radio programming and technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend. Thanks for calling and listening.